And for Descartes, we'll remember those properties were clear and distinct. So he looked into his mind's eye, as it were, his mind mirroring the world, and said whichever representations are clear and distinct are true. Locke, on the other hand, said whichever representations can be seen to be derived from sense are true. That's how we know they're a correct copy. And of course, philosophy does more than that, too. Through analysis, right, and reflexive contemplation, presumably the philosopher not only picks out the right representation, but sort of polishes the mirror up. So he can see a little more clearly in the future. He clarifies concepts, as it were, or so the locutions run. Now, there was a problem we found with positing that veil of ideas, right, that stands between us and the world, that show between our ears, as it were. The problem was skepticism. It's impossible to prove that, in fact, there is any world beyond just that veil of ideas, and that if it is there, that those ideas correspond or copy the world, which is the self-defined notion of truth. Which is to say, it's hard to tell whether our ideas correspond with the way the world, capital R, really is. Now, Kant tried to solve this problem with his Copernican Revolution. Right? He introduced the notion of a conceptual scheme that, in fact, a lot of our interpretation of the world is supplied by ourselves, our own minds. In so doing, Kant was able to make epistemology as the study and range of all possible knowledge within our mind-imposed a priori conceptual scheme, the architectonic discipline, or what we might call first philosophy, which was the position that metaphysics had taken for Aristotle. Now, I think you've learned from Professor Segrou that Hegel undermined this project, right? He showed us that all of those conceptual schemes are historically contingent. They change over time, and they change across space. There are presumably cultures that do not have the notion of cause and effect. There may be cultures which do not have the, richly developed notion of physical four-dimensional objects, and therefore conceptual schemes are themselves contingent. And that, of course, as we know, led to the profusion of speculative metaphysical systems, because we found that science itself is just one conceptual scheme, and we got the flights of imaginative fancy. And then the positivists responded. They had to nail that conceptual scheme down to something so that they could get back to first philosophy, to the serious foundational task of grounding our beliefs. And what they did was turned linguistic. They took the conceptual scheme out of the mind and put it into language. So, thus, modern linguistic analysis is again an epistemological first philosophy. Language and its meanings have replaced mind in its ideas. And in fact, they are the exact same medium, but in a different form. Right? And, of course, language and its meanings now are the representations which stand between ourselves and the world. And linguistic expressions are therefore said to be true when they accurately represent, copy, mirror, picture, or correspond to reality. And various philosophers have introduced new words that are basically synonymous with the others so that they can somehow seem new and unique. We're getting somewhere with this project. It's not just spinning its wheels. Rorty doesn't even bother to try and refute it so much, because Quine has already refuted it. He wants to ask a more interesting question. Why bother? Why bother give foundations? What's the instinct back there? And what he argues is that what underlies such philosophical projects and what unites them to their Platonic forerunners and forebearers is the desire to constitute philosophy as a metacultural criticism. Right? It is literally the desire to have a God's eye view of things. So the philosopher, through studying the medium of representation,